La da dee la da 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 do.
Where were we?
Oh,
have some sourdough bread in the oven. You gotta take it out.
Tough.
Okay. Welcome back to Decades on Dirt Roads. This is Catherine.
And this is Maddie.
And today we're sitting down with Jim and Holly Akinson. They are the authors of 7,003 Days, 21 Years in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness.
We were welcomed into their home, which was super fun for us. Selfishly, Catherine and I, we obviously get to chat with these people over the phone, and then to get welcomed into their home where they have all these fun artifacts, not only from living in the Frank Church, but all the other eras of their life. It's super fun to see all the cool stuff that they have, and then obviously the conversations being had were very worthwhile. They lived such an interesting life. They met
At Eastern.
They were in a biology class or something?
I'm not quite sure, but it felt very similar to me and my husband's origin story. They're two researchers, very devoted to the lifestyle that they got to live at Taylor Ranch. They really wanted to still be out in the field, and I can definitely relate to that. So they necessarily didn't have as great of trajectory as they could have had, but really they got to do what they loved, and that is as inspiring as anything. So they talk about their time in this really remote area where they were stationed. They talk about the fires of 2000. And you'll hear a little bit their dogs running around. They're both search and rescue trained cadaver dogs and something else, but yeah, you'll hear them throughout. We did our best with them, but
yeah, the golden retrievers could only be quiet for so long.
I think I pet one of their dogs the whole episode. She wanted some love, and I was here.
But yeah, Catherine brings up a good point as far as their commitment to the lifestyle that is that was required at Taylor Ranch, and I think that's so far and few between. We ended up talking about it maybe after the podcast, or maybe it's included of the lifestyle of being secluded and being out there and having to live like those before you.
Yeah.
So thanks. Thanks for listening, and huge thanks to Jim and Holly for letting us hang out with them for the afternoon.
Yeah, and to the Hunsakers for recommending them and putting us in contact.
Yep, and Mark and Ted, you guys are also featured in this episode.
All right, well, let's get into it. Okay, I think we're good to go.
Awesome. Well, welcome to the show, Holly and Jim. I think we'll start with maybe a little introduction of how you guys met, and then, you know, moving into early career before we get into the meat and potatoes of being in the Frank Church.
Okay. Go ahead on how we met.
We met at Eastern Oregon University. We were both students there. And I was Jim's TA for biology. And so that's how we got to know each other and decided we were interested in each other. Our first date, we went out looking for elk and saw elk babies. And I was already thinking, you know, maybe this is the guy for me. And I think the next dates were maybe going with Jim on bow hunts.
Perfect.
Backpacking in the wilderness. And that kind of locked it up. Nice. As far as my interest.
Yep.
How about you?
Similar. I think, yeah. You have the story straight.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I wooed him, I guess.
Yeah.
You're willing to go along.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it all revolved around activities in the outdoors.
And we did match up really well that way. When we got married, we told people not to give us any gifts that were electric, because we didn't think we would be living somewhere that we'd have electricity.
Hmm.
And so somehow, I guess we knew something that we didn't really know, but we lived on a fire lookout for a little while, Glass Hill out of La Grande.
Really?
And there was no electricity there. And then we moved to Taylor Ranch for 21 years.
Yeah.
And there was not electricity there. So we kind of knew that's what we wanted.
Yeah.
First part, there's no electricity. Electricity did come along later, which is, you probably read in our book, was questionable. I mean, there were certainly aspects that were nice, but there was an element that was somehow somewhat lost. having electricity and all the communication advantages that come with electricity.
I was personally happy with the electricity. We got electricity in 1997 or 98 with hydropower. And the day we got it, I flew out and bought a washing machine. I'm the one that does that kind of stuff. So we, but prior to that, we had had a wringer washer that ran off of a gasoline Briggs & Stratton engine and belched out fumes while you were hand cranking your laundry to rinse it.
Yeah, nice to have fumes on your
and
wet
then
clothes.
That was upgraded to one that you just used your hand and sloshed it back and forth to wash your clothes. And I just said, nope, we have electricity. I'm getting a washing machine.
Right, Holly deserves one.
Yeah. But there was a lot.
But I agree with the communication. As communications improved and we had internet, we lost some of that cohesiveness of community that we had with students. Because they would go do their own thing instead of us doing everything together.
And the whole backcountry is a community because it all revolved, the Idaho backcountry, the biggest wilderness complex in the lower 48. It all revolved around the backcountry radio, which ultimately has been discontinued. There's no need for it now because there's all kinds of satellite communication. And, you know, it was a massive party line. And you knew everybody else's business, and they knew ours.
Right.
But it made us a community.
Certainly.
That it's kind of hard to describe and replicate. And that is going to be probably the second book.
Really?
About the backcountry radio. Mm-hmm. We've already interviewed a number of people that lived in the similar time period as us. And we're dependent upon the backcountry radio, which is pretty cool. Everybody's got good stories, and some of them we knew because we'd eavesdropped on the events as they happened.
Yeah. I mean, how else do you entertain? Like, you can only play so many rounds of cards.
Yeah.
But it also really integrated us together, and what I really liked about we called it the backcountry community, was that, you know, we all voted differently. We had different political perspectives, but when November came and everybody's water froze up, everybody was your best friend to say, oh, can you believe it? We lost our water today. Or, oh, the hydro broke down and I don't know how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And so we had something that really bonded us all together, even though we were all there in the backcountry for different reasons and had different views and different perspectives. But we were really bound together. And we still keep in close contact with all of those people.
Yeah,
because that was such an important part of our lives. We didn't have people living at Taylor necessarily some winters in the wilderness except the two of us. So our communications were with other people on this radio.
And the operator of the radio service, which was Arnold Aviation out of Cascade. And Carol Arnold was like our den mother, so to speak.
She was.
Den mother, counselor.
Yeah.
She took care of us.
She did. And worried about us.
Well, we'd stay at her house when we flew out. Like, if we'd fly in and out to Taylor Ranch, where we lived, if the weather was bad, we might spend a week sitting out waiting for the weather to fly. And she'd invite us to stay with her. She'd go help me do laundry if I had 10 loads from the winter.
And for the sake of the listeners, what years were you at the lookout, and then what years were you in the Frame Church?
It's a field station, is what it was, a University of Idaho field station, which really had been an outfitting ranch for its first 60 or 70 years. And in late 60s, 1970-ish, University of Idaho purchased this facility and began to make it a field station, and really didn't get the ball rolling, I would say, truly, until they were able to hire full-time managers, and that's what we were, although we shared one full-time position initially. And we started in 1982, and we worked there for 8 years, and then we came out in 1990 for 7 years, and that's when I did the bear and cougar work, research with Ted Craddock and for Oregon Fish and Wildlife. And Holly had a consulting business. And then the job came open again with some slight advancement opportunities.
No, it was changed.
It was changed. But so in 1997, we went back for 13 more years.
How did you guys happen upon that first stint there? How did you happen upon that job?
Well, we were doing research in La Grande on great gray owls, and Evelyn Bull worked for the Forest Service. She was our supervisor, and she was a U of I grad, and so she had heard about it. And she didn't want us to leave to go do that, so she didn't tell us till the last day. So we handwrote our application the last night and mailed it. And said we'd be willing to share one job. Evidently, we were too good to
pass up
with the two for one.
Certainly.
Two well-trained biologists.
That was kind of stupid.
Yeah, that's a hell of a deal.
Yeah, but it worked.
You wanted it bad enough.
We did.
Yeah, and it led to other things.
We did. So we were the first managers, so there were some issues with kind of resolving and changing things. And, I mean, basically, we were the only employees there, so the plane flew us in and dropped us off, and we're like, okay, wonder what we do with our jobs.
Yeah.
So we were responsible for facilities, and then at that time we helped with coordinating educational activities. And when we came back the second time, we were in a different role. We were manager scientists, and so we'd already started some programs previously, but we developed more education programs. And we were interested in going back to do predator research. Jim had done the bear and cougar research in Oregon and had helped out on the cougar and bobcat research when we had been at Taylor Ranch in the 80s.
Early
so
80s.
I don't know if you said our second tenure then started in 1997 and went to 2010.
Yep.
Gotcha.
And so that we were more focused on education programs and doing the carnivore research, but we still had the responsibility for managing facilities. So basically, we had to do everything.
Right.
Or we could have, you know, we were able to get some help to assist with some of the facility management.
Yeah, that was one chapter in here. You know, just the day-to-day routines. Obviously, that I cannot imagine what it's like to go into the Taylor Ranch here in this beautiful place, but the shock and awe kind of dies down. And then you have to be the manager of that place. So can you kind of speak to that and what that was like, finding that routine with your husband and kind of making that place what it was?
So we had, you know, long-term goals, short-term goals, daily goals. We had seasons that were different. So summer was our big student season. We had two undergraduate programs that we supervised in the summer, and that's when most of the graduate students came in. So that was our time period for doing education. Mm-hmm. Winter was when we did research because we didn't have those obligations for working with students, although we did hire a lot of our students to help us on the research. But that was why we focused our cougar and wolf research on winter. Mm. And the location of Taylor Ranch was very conducive to that because it was on winter range. So all the deer and elk and bighorn sheep and cougars and wolves all showed up around us in the wintertime. When we took the students to check wolf dens, we had to take the stock and travel long distances to be able to get close to where the wolves were in the summertime.
And I think the adventure part was huge, and I think that it almost became addictive in our first tenure.
Totally.
Not only Holly mentioned working on the cougar and the bobcat study, but we did our own research on bighorn sheep. Holly did her master's research on bighorns, and then we did another project locating previously pretty much undocumented bighorn lambing areas, and traveled some pretty significant
distances.
Some major
distances. Backpacking trips with very heavy loads that ruined some knees.
Yeah, certainly. You guys know how to hike to pretty deep places.
Yes. Yeah. But I think also related to what Jim said about being addicted to being there, I think we had like a nature addiction.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
That we just we had to be there. We had to be in nature, and particularly like in the winter and the spring, nobody else was in the wilderness. So we knew when we hiked the trails, anything we saw or anything that was happening was uninfluenced by people. It was all just natural, and even just the seasonal rhythms of what happens in each season, and the ice would break up and flow out like in Alaska, and so we'd always be interested whenever we'd hear this ice giant out. Whoosh of ice breaking up and flowing down the stream like three or four times as high as it had been before it broke up. But so many natural systems that were happening were just like, they made us feel very happy.
Right. The way you wrote about that in the book with just the indoor plumbing, I thought that was so interesting.
Oh, yeah. Like looking at the shower like it was magic the first time in the spring.
Yeah.
You know, when you have those kind of accommodations where you have flowing water all the time, you don't really think about that. But when you don't have it and it suddenly appears, it's like the most wonderful thing ever. I get to have a real shower.
Yeah.
And then how did we decide upon this place to live, I think is another thing of significance, because when we knew in probably about 2008, overlapping over into 2009, we likely would be leaving soon, Taylor Ranch, we started looking at where could we possibly live that could come close to matching this. Mm. And we had a short list, of which Enterprise, Oregon was, I felt, number three on the list.
But the
jobs brought us here, is what it amounted to.
But prior to that, we thought that we would probably retire to Northeastern Oregon. And, you know, previously we had been based in La Grande. I graduated from high school in Baker City.
Gotcha.
But we went to college in La Grande. We got married in La Grande. When we came back between the two tenures at Taylor Ranch, we lived in La Grande. So we were sort of looking for a small property to buy and just like have it until we were ready to retire. And it took us quite a few years to find a property, but we actually found a property out of Elgin on Shaw Creek,
up
the Indian Creek Road. We were originally looking for like 10 acres and a small house, but we found lots of large houses or lots of large properties with no house, no possibility of building on. But through connections, we found out about someone who had 65 acres in a one-room cabin, and she had managed it with conservation and naturalness as the focus of her management plan. And that's what we wanted to do with the land was, you know, to be good stewards of the land. So we have a 65-acre ponderosa pine property that we go to often. It has a stream flowing through it, and it's the end of the power line and the end of the road. And it's down in a little low spot. We can't see or hear anybody else.
So we go there and we need to get away from the hubbub of Enterprise.
Right. Yeah.
Big city living. We get tired of all this traffic.
Right. Yeah. No, it's high traffic area.
There's been talk of a traffic light here lately.
Yeah, you got to get out of here at that point.
I know.
But unfortunately, then I got a job in Enterprise with Willow Resources, and it's an hour drive from where our property was, so we decided that was really too much for commuting back and forth for an hour, and so that's when we decided that we were going to have to get a place closer.
Gotcha. That's how you ended up here. That's pretty cool. So before... Obviously, there's a lot that goes into the fires of 2000. I think that'll be a good conversation. But to kind of stay on your guys' research end of things, you know, talk about that, what that was like. You go in and you have this 6 or 7 year stint where you're at Taylor Ranch, and then you leave and you go do research. There's a lot of different lenses that you can look through of just like, man, we were in the wilderness, this really secluded area. You really are one with the ecosystem, which isn't, you don't have to navigate the human topography that's out there. Mm-hmm. You are in and amongst everything that you're researching. And then you come out and you work with Ted and you do all that. And then you go back in. Can you speak to kind of that transition, or what were some of the highlights as a researcher during that?
Well, I will say that the work that I did with Ted, the constant day in and day out cougar and bear capture, was probably the most thrilling work that I've done in my career. Mm. Just hard to beat for sheer day in, day out excitement. But the lifestyle package that the Frank Church offered is unmatchable. Maybe some situations in Alaska could match it, but for the lower 48, there was times in the winter where, we would go 2 weeks, 3 weeks without seeing another person, and we knew we were the only two in the Big Creek drainage, a 60-mile long drainage.
Your nearest neighbor was 21 miles by trail.
Right, Twin B Ranch.
And, that's a haul.
And yeah, it is. And
that would be 7 hours on a fast horse.
And winter changed everything because it really made distances more expansive. But we lived what we did there. It was not like a 40-hour-a-week job. Hmm. Not to say the cougar and the bear research was, because that wasn't either.
It was about a 60-hour-a-week job.
Yeah.
But it's...
I never saw him when he worked with Ted.
Right.
They'd get up at 3 in the morning and go do their thing, and then they'd talk in the evening until they both went to sleep.
And then we needed to sleep. That's pretty much the way it was. But I don't know. It had that living, breathing, experiencing component there that is just so hard to replace. I'm not sure it is replaceable. And I think the times were right too. We were kind of in the end of that time period where there was still hands-on discovery research going on in the field, where now so much of what's done if you're a scientist is looking at that massive body of work that everybody else has done. And maybe analyzing the results a little bit differently, or modeling is big. But it was still, we need to know fundamentally, one, what the effect of wolves are going to be on the local cougar population, and then ultimately the ungulates. And, you know, those are really fundamental types of questions. Mm-hmm. Bobcats, when I helped Gary Kohler doing his bobcat research, it was very baseline information. What's the density? How many are there in a given area? Mm-hmm. What's the reproductive rates and all these sorts of things?
Yeah.
So we got in on some of that, I think. And it was sort of, I look around now and I don't see many opportunities like those anymore. Not to say that there aren't. You might have to go more internationally, but mm-hmm. I think it was... We were in a nice time period that way.
I was going to say, like Jim said, when we went back, because he had done all that cougar research, we were quite interested in the cougars and what we would see, whether we'd see a change with cougars, with wolves moving into the area, because the wolves had been released into the wilderness in 1995 and 1996.
So that was in the middle between your guys' 10 years, right?
Yes.
Yeah, close to when we went back.
So
got it.
So then we went back in 1997 and said, let's do a cougar study and so we can see what's happening. Mm-hmm. Well, the very year we started our study, the wolves were already there. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd have a few years before the wolf numbers built up so we had a pack in our area. But there was a pack right away. And we saw some pretty significant changes, and we're quite active in the field with trying to track all that and keep track of it. And
the other thing, technologically, GPS collars weren't out yet. So the VHF collars, where you had to go out there and locate an animal, was still the cutting edge science.
Is that like the telemetry stuff?
Yeah, yes. Telemetry, right.
So the wolves were radio collared by the Nez Perce tribe, who had authority at that time for Idaho wolves. And then we did cougar capture.
And some wolf capture.
And wolf capture later on to put additional collars out so we could track them.
But
we did have to do the tracking either by ground or in an airplane, because they weren't GPS oriented. So we were very hands-on with what we had to do.
And we were connected under the umbrella of the Hornocker Wildlife Institute. And that whole place's existence and ownership of the University of Idaho is due to Morris Hornocker doing his Hallmark cougar research there in the 60s. And he convinced the Taylors, namesake of Taylor Ranch, to sell to the University of Idaho for research and educational purposes. So we were working. We went back. Part of our employment was with the University of Idaho, and the other part was with the Hornocker Institute. And that was
because, again, we went back sharing a job.
Yeah.
And so then we found ways to supplement our income by getting grants or doing research with funding from other sources.
Yeah, our connection.
So we ended up being two full-time positions, but it was scattered among different funding sources.
Right, you had to get pretty creative with that.
Yeah.
I was going to say one of the other interesting things I think that we did with research that's really almost unheard of, because we lived back there, we had such a connection to the land and the history, from sheep eater Indians to the people that moved back there and homesteaded. So we looked at our data of the ungulates, the deer and the elk and bighorn sheep, and there were also moose back there and mountain goats. And we looked at various databases to compare over time what those populations were like. And our first data set was excavations from an archaeological excavation a half mile from Taylor Ranch.
Wow.
We were involved.
The second data set was a homesteader diary from 1895 to 1897, and then there was a second one more than that.
It was 5 years.
Where we, these people wrote in their diary often just one line a day, but it might say, we shot three deer, or we collected a cougar we poisoned with strychnine. Mm-hmm.
They shot what they saw, which actually made pretty good documentation of relative abundance.
Yeah.
So we used what the sheep eater Indians ate and was in their excavations of their house pits for that data set. Then we used the homesteaders of what they shot and saw and wrote in their diary.
Yeah.
And then we moved forward to some early Forest Service winter range surveys and other documentation from other homesteaders, and then some fish and game surveys, and then Morris Hornocker's cougar research in the 60s. So we had this 2,000-year data set, and it really did show some trends.
Wow.
So it's just fascinating to put together these different kind of pieces of data that aren't like hard science, but I think they were reasonable estimations of how things changed proportionally between the different animals. And when the sheep eater Indians were there, it was primarily bighorn sheep. And then the population changed, and there was mostly mule deer. And then the homesteaders shot all the coyotes, and there were really a lot of mule deer. And then there was a hard winter, and it crashed, and the mule deer all died. And then some elk moved into the area and just started increasing and increasing. And by the time we did our research, it was like 2/3 elk and 1/3 deer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bighorn sheep were marginal. Moose started coming in to the picture. So I thought that was really a fun look over time. And you know, people think of wilderness as being like this unchanging, we're not gonna affect the environment, it just needs to stay the way it is. Mm-mm. Well, it's not stable at all.
No.
It's very dynamic, and that was kind of a fun graph. We had a graph that we made of change over time.
From some logistical perspectives, though, there's, and Holly mentioned that diary, the Caswell diary, it was actually 1895 to 1903. And to put everything in perspective, these guys were fascinating brothers, the Caswell brothers, and not only did they homestead on Big Creek and raise a garden and have some livestock and everything, they discovered gold at Thunder Mountain, which is about 25 trail miles away. They built trails to get there. They got watches, and they were fascinated by time, and in their diary, left the ranch in 903, arrived at, what was the name of their camp?
Mule
Creek, yeah. arrived at Mule Creek at right at dark, which was 9:07 tonight.
And that would be it for the day.
That would be the entry.
Oh my gosh.
But on the other hand, their influence, I thought about them, you know, we probably rode 2,000 miles mule back doing our research.
Yeah.
Just doing the wintertime research stuff. And I would think about them a lot, you know, and I'd look
check
at my
watch.
Yeah, I better time this, this event.
Yeah, let's see if we can match their record time.
But they were super hard workers, so even though they had like one thing a day in their diary, they would have things like worked on making a bathtub out of a cottonwood log.
Huh.
Sewed myself a pair of gloves out of deer hide.
Made soap.
I mean, they were making everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
lazy
is probably not an adjective that gets used.
No, they just were like busy beavers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, we were researchers in that environment, but in order to function effectively, we had to buy in to a lot of these old ways of doing things.
Totally.
And I guess that's something that I wish were more common in today's world. And,
yeah.
You know, you talked about things we experienced, and it really was like time travel almost, even though in a way we drug some, I guess, higher science techniques, that sort of information into this existence from the past. And I don't know, and looking back, what do I value the most? I value most the capability to function just like the Caswell brothers did, or Dave Lewis, who was the original homesteader at Taylor Ranch. And I know that if I were plunked back in 1885, I'd be just fine because I had those skills that we developed while we were in there.
Yeah, you had to adapt for the sake of your adventure.
Right. And I think it was valuable for the students, too. I know it was, that came back there and experienced what they experienced and interacted with us, because we got them involved in stock use, horse mule packing. We put up hay with the mule team.
I love those stories about the hay.
Yeah, and we did all those things the old way.
Yeah.
And it just, to me, that is the most valuable thing.
Yeah.
And we had a reunion with our students, our interns, last summer, which was, it was cool. It was kind of emotional and interesting to see everybody now, you know, that they're in their 40s. And a lot of them have kids that are in their teens or older, going to college. And but on the other hand, the things that they wanted to talk about were how are the mules doing, and boy, we sure miss putting up hay. And they'll talk some about the research component, but it was kind of a sidelight to the lifestyle, I would say.
The whole environment of living in the wilderness for a summer was really engaging for students, and I think the faculty and administration might have been a little put off when we would often say, "Oh, yeah, well, the students say that they learn more at Taylor Ranch than they did all their years in classrooms in college."
Yeah, they were definitely put off.
But it was it was a transition time, and you know, at that age, you're gonna, you know, young people transition anyway to becoming responsible adults, and that the parents told us, you know, "Wow, my child was at Taylor Ranch and they came home a whole different person."
Right.
And the things that changed, it might have been things like putting up hay.
Yeah, well, it's like life skills instead of like school stuff.
Yeah, the life skills.
There was that confidence of, oh, I can do this. I mean, we like to mix up our students and have like real brainy ones and then some, you know, rural kid that grew up on a farm and maybe didn't have a lot of other experiences, we'd mix them together, which wasn't always ideal, but I think it was helpful because they had to deal with different people, and that's all our social group was.
Right.
So they adapted, and one of the really smart city people, you know, said, we'd always ask the students at the end, you know, we'd do an exit interview, what was your favorite thing? And I asked her, and she said, I learned about my body. I learned what I could do physically, and I had no idea.
Mm.
And it was about the haying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this job we had to get done, and we used the students to do it. But really, that's what people pay big money to do a, what do they call it, a bonding experience with a group. Well, everybody could pick the job that worked for them. If you couldn't handle a lot of weight, you could pitchfork a little bit up onto the wagon. If you had some technical skills, you could do that. And everybody was a part of the whole. And so we all needed each other as a team. So it was very much team building, even though it was sort of a functional thing for us that we needed the job done so the mules could live there in the winter.
Right. This is just another chore for you guys, but for these kids, this is...
And it was team building.
Totally.
We did this over the course of the summer. So it was like summer employment for a lot of these students. And now there's a course offering called Semester in the Wild, which is obviously a similar block of time, but they're doing it a little bit more on an academic timeline with a variety of topics coming and going, and so that's a good thing. It's good to see. I still wish that there could be that immersed, hands-on learning opportunity built in.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just you think back on some of the experiences we had, like you and the students got chased by a moose once, didn't you, if I remember right?
We tried to beat it, keep it from killing us.
Yeah.
Beat it with a stick.
We were going to look for wolves. Wolves are real gentle, easygoing animals compared to a cow moose.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you know.
Yeah.
Or like when we trapped a pup wolf, and, you know, it was an accidental trapping, but it was pretty cool for students to be able to... And we had to obviously drug the wolf to get it out of the trap, and but then everybody got to handle it and look at it. And it was right next to a den, which we crawled in and measured and documented. And those sorts of experiences, I think, really make those people go on to be better natural resource professionals, because they can directly relate to something.
Totally.
And it could be that they go on to work in a different field. But I don't know, it builds some character and resilience, I think.
Well, and like, you're not going to remember every lecture you sat through, but by damn, you're going to remember the day you held a wolf.
Well, right,
Those field classes and labs and stuff are the most important thing.
Well, and that's what engages people to do the dry work that they have to in classes. I mean, all of your studies isn't that exciting, but if you have that drive, like, I had this wonderful time with those wolves. I want a career in this field.
I got to get this done so I could go do that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what it amounts to. But I would say that, you know, a lot of people have asked us over the years, and that's one reason why I wanted to write this book, was what was our most exciting, dramatic experience? And there's no question it was the forest fire of 2000. And just because it was life-threatening for an extended period of time. And we were in a situation that has brought about a lot of changes to the forest policy in terms of allowing residents to live in remote places. Now they're evacuated. No ands, ifs, or buts.
Right.
Don't have any choice. But our experience, though, I think surviving what we survived is a testimony to our adaptability and our functioning in a community environment, because what we went through at the Flying Bee Ranch on the Middle Fork, for all of us to go through that firestorm experience and nobody die, I think is a testament to we planned well.
Right, and that's remarkable.
Yeah, it was remarkable.
Of course, it was also kind of an enlightenment that, you know what, when you're in the wilderness...
Yeah.
Mother Nature's in control.
Yeah, right. You're in the wilderness. Yeah.
You don't just call 911.
I think the sad thing with that whole deal is if there would have been three of our, 12 or 14 people, there would have been three people that died, it would have been a story of significance and probably even been a movie.
You mean newsworthy.
Yeah, probably even been a movie. But the fact that we made it through with, you know, a few cuts and bruises and a few burns, but we came through it pretty much unscathed.
So. It still was movie worthy. It just didn't happen.
Right, it was movie worthy. There's no question. And I think that now there's been so many similar sorts of things happening in California, just around the West, similar, that people can't understand what it's like, I don't think, to be in that scale of a fire with no vehicular assist opportunity. Because, you know, we fled on horseback from Taylor Ranch and got to the Flying Bee just in time to do a few days of preparation and kind of dramatic evacuation of others, and then be prepared for something that we had no idea the scale that we were getting into, and then surviving it, and then dealing with the aftermath of it. And to me, that was something that I think was taken for granted. We let it be to some degree, because like the crew from the Flying Bee had the opportunity for counseling after that, and we didn't really.
Mm-mm. Well, we could have had an opportunity.
Yeah, we could have. And
but at the time, you know, you think, I don't need that.
Right.
But I know I actually did experience some post-traumatic stress in different ways. I don't think it was, you know, anything severe, but after the fire, whenever I'd smell smoke, like from a prescribed burn or any kind of forest fire, my heart would start racing, because that's what my heart remembered, that smell is associated with being afraid.
And there was that house fire when we were living up Ski Run Road. I remember you talked about seeing the flames and having flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. And just for clarification, this was 2007, right?
2000.
And you guys got burned over.
We were burned over.
We left Taylor Ranch as we had fire on three sides of Taylor Ranch, and we went 21 miles
to the nearest neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
On the Middle Fork of the Salmon.
Middle Fork of the Salmon, and two fires had burned together at Taylor Ranch. Then they joined three other fires that burned together at the Flying Bee 4 days later. And so we weren't at Taylor Ranch when the fire burned it, but it did burn it the day we left.
Yeah.
And we had firefighters there after the fire had come through. And then when we were at the Flying Bee, it burned while we were there.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yep. And it, I don't know, it just, the whole thing, it's getting to be a lot of years ago now, 24 years, you know, and we were kind of, at that time, still, I guess, kind of in our prime, so to speak. But reflecting back, I've often thought, would I do anything or much differently in that situation, having the knowledge we have now? And I don't think so, probably. I mean, we had some interesting moments, and the general manager of the Flying Bee Corporation came in. It was the day, wasn't it, the day before the fire got to us? And we were all sitting around the breakfast table, and he said, who wants to go? He says, I'm more than happy to fly you guys out of here. And at that time, I think we did have the
We had two firefighters from the Forest Service.
Yeah. Did we have Doug Graves there yet?
Yeah, Doug was one of the two.
Okay, it was just two. But anyway, there was those folks, the Flying Bee employees, and then Holly and I from Taylor Ranch.
And Chris, one of our students.
Chris McDaniel.
Jim asked him to come back in to help us get back to Taylor.
He came in that day. Was he in on that conversation, though?
He probably wasn't.
I don't think he was in on that. But anyway, just to go around, you know, one by one saying, no, I think we're going to stay. You know, now reflecting back on that, there was probably some of those individuals that needed to be flown out, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, there was one that was very concerned, a woman that was not in great health, and she was quite scared originally, but then we came up with a plan of, okay, when the fire hits, we're going to do this, and everybody had an assignment, and so even she said, no, I'm going to stay. I feel comfortable. We have a plan. We were a little naive at the time, but
yeah.
So everybody stayed.
Yeah, it was so surreal, though, to be in a pitch black environment, knowing it's a totally clear day otherwise.
Like at 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So yeah. Were you grateful to have that new communication options, or was that...
Well, the backcountry radio...
that was still what we mostly used.
Really? Yeah, okay,
we got bailed out, maybe not bailed out, but our communication that really came through for us, you did have a ground-to-air to talk to a pilot.
And we did have a Soviet emailer.
That's what I'm going to talk about. that failed us as we're
from the Hornacher Institute, because they were doing research in Russia, Soviet Union, Siberia, at that time.
On tigers. But anyway, we're traveling down Big Creek, and this is leaving Taylor Ranch, and we didn't really know what we were in for, except for we had fled a fire front that we were moving faster than. So we knew we were in pretty good shape. Mm-hmm. So we went to use that stupid thing, and we couldn't link up with a satellite, or we thought we'd sent the message.
I thought I had sent it. Yeah. I typed up a little message to let the university know what was going on, right. Just to say we're leaving Taylor Ranch. There's fire here.
Yeah.
And we actually...
And they never got it.
And prior to leaving Taylor Ranch, again, the backcountry radio came through. We couldn't reach anybody by other means except for the radio, and we couldn't get a hold of Arnold Aviation, but we were able to lie down. We were able to get a hold of one of our neighbors on the main Salmon River and tell them we're headed to the Flying Bee Ranch. We've had to evacuate on the ground. The jumpers couldn't jump out of the plane because there's too much turbulence mm-hmm. at the fire front. Mm-hmm. So we see this plane go on, and the pilot, he does the wing wave, basically, and I knew, okay. And then they're lining out back to McCall.
Yeah.
I knew that we were on our own.
The bros are out.
Yeah, that's right.
The bros are not landing.
We're not landing.
They're not jumping.
No.
They're not jumping. So, yeah, so I raced up and announced that to Holly, and Holly's very methodical at times, and so she was down in the basement getting together what we needed for this evacuation. And pulling food off the shelves, and I had mani tarps laid on the lawn in front of the Taylor cabin, and that's, when you pack, you bundle your stuff up in that. Mm-hmm. And we also had some pannier bags. You just toss your stuff in and hang it on the side of the pack cell, which is quicker and easier. Mm-hmm. And I said to Holly, get up here. We have got to go now. And I could just hear this roaring, and you could see... embers that were probably 1,000 feet in the air that were to the west coming our way. And it was like, we got to get out of here. Yeah.
There were spot fires just all over the place.
So that's the conditions under which we left Taylor Ranch. And, we're kind of high adrenaline and amped up. And Holly's trying to get a few pictures. We'd flown out the video camera, which was really a shame. Because that would have been pretty valuable footage to have had.
So timeline wise, obviously these two fires had come together. What was the timeline of you guys knowing that those were there, and kind of your awareness and familiarity with fire in the wilderness to, okay, this really could start affecting us to, hey, we're packing up, Holly, we gotta go.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say the year of that fire was a year of big fires in central Idaho. That's when Bill Clinton went to visit a fire out of McCall.
Yeah,
and so there had been fires everywhere in the backcountry. So by the time our fire started, everybody was kind of sick of fires.
Right.
There was, like, I think 500,000 acres burned that year
August
in
the
central
18th.
Idaho. Mm-hmm. And so the Forest Service had a model they were looking at of fire behavior, and so they weren't very concerned that they needed to get in. At one point, Jim called the Forest Service and said, we really think we need some assistance, and but because these other fires were going on, they had, not a lot of resources.
Right.
And they thought they'd have a few days before they dealt with us, they could deal with these other fires. Mm-hmm. And so that was like a few days before. And at that point, we were evacuating other groups. And then our students, we were supposed to fly out the day before the fire anyway. And so we had to wait until the flames or the smoke was improved in the middle of the day to get them out.
You had to fly them out.
to fly them out. And so it probably wasn't until the evening that they left, the evening before the fire hit Taylor Ranch, that, I mean, we could just see all the flames. They were about 2 miles from us, and substantial fire. And that was when we called Arnold Aviation and said, can you bring a plane in? We want to get some stuff out of here. And we filled a plane with 1,000 pounds of stuff in 15 minutes. It's just like, take this, take that.
Yeah.
You know, university records and some of our personal stuff. And just we filled it until the pilot said, okay.
Yeah.
Nothing else will fit.
Yeah, I can't get out of here if you keep putting things in here. Yeah.
Again, then our family connectivity in our community was huge then, too. It was the Arnold. That was Ray Arnold was the pilot. Carol Arnold was aware of our need. And so all of a sudden, you know, whoever was available to help was involved in helping us.
Yeah, the plane was already doing something else, and they just diverted it. So that's why it got there so fast.
Gotcha.
It was right before dark.
Yeah. And then there were some other, you know, we were aware of how the fire was behaving. It would have these lay down periods. And what was dangerous is when it got clear. When we were breathing this nasty smoke day in and day out, it wasn't moving far. It was kind of smoldering. And in our local outfitter, Steve Zettel, he actually came down, spent a night, and then he opted to go back upstream past the fire when it was laid down in the morning. But he knew he could get to his camp and I think stabilize things and then go up a different trail system to get out of there.
But the flames chased him up the other trail that they went on.
They
were in worse danger than we were.
At that time, yeah. But anyway.
But everybody was helping everyone.
Right.
They showed up at midnight, knocked on our door. It's like, okay, yeah, here's some food. And put the horses away. And, you know, that's just what people did in the backcountry when you needed help. And I think in the book I had written about when we were fleeing the fire and we got to the Middle Fork of the Salmon, and we ran into a rafting party and told them our story, and we were still like super jazzed, like, yeah, just keep going. And they said, oh no, why don't you come spend the night with us? Well, we were in such a hurry to leave. We didn't have sleeping bags. We didn't have a change of clothes. I don't think we even had a jacket. But they fed us. They gave us sleeping bags.
Oh,
and people were trying to offer us their clothes. And, you know, it's easier to give to other people than to accept.
Yeah.
It was really awkward, you know.
When
we knew we needed things and people wanted to give it to us. And we're like, well, no, I don't need your jacket.
Yeah.
The bad thing about that, staying with that party, which had the recently retired governor, Cecil Andrews, was on that trip. And we'd gotten to know him through a cabin move we did. He says, hey, I know that couple. They're the folks from Taylor Ranch. Come on down. So, yeah, it was really hard to not accept that hospitality. But the thing that I...
So we did, though.
We did.
Yeah.
But I regret not, well, leaving the folks at the Flying B, not knowing what became of us.
We didn't know that they knew, but they had crossed over their two radio channels, and they had called the other radio channel that we use and found out that we were headed to the Flying B Ranch.
Yeah.
And so
they stayed up all night.
The guy stayed up all night in the tack shed waiting for us.
To
show
then
they sent people down to find us.
Sent some riders to come meet us. So, you know, that was a kind of an awkwardness. But it's characteristic of communication at that time period.
Well, I think it was really kind of a warm welcome that, I mean, they cared so much that they waited all night and then sent these people to make sure we were okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, they didn't have all the information, so what they told us was everything had burned up at Taylor Ranch, and that was a huge, sad shock, you know, because if all the buildings are burned, we don't really have a job anymore.
But there again, in credit to the Forest Service firefighters, they ultimately, I think, saved the place.
Yeah.
Because the plane went back. They reduced in their numbers, I think, too. They got in the helicopter.
Yeah.
And they came in, and it was
in
really smoky. But one of the jumpers, I guess, they were jumpers that were in a helicopter, and knew Big Creek. And he says, well, we'll go upstream and keep an eye peeled for the bridge. And when you're at the bridge, you pop over and you can land in the field. And then they just went into fire control, and they really saved a lot of buildings.
Yeah.
I think there was 8 of them, which must have been a pretty big helicopter.
8 firefighters.
At least a ranger. Yeah. Okay. But at any rate...
we lost a few buildings, but they were the least valuable of the buildings.
Right.
And so we felt good if we had to pick 3. Those would have been the ones we'd pick.
Yeah. So you still got to come home to your home.
We did.
Yeah.
It was all black.
Right.
Yeah. But we got to come
home. It's still standing. That's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. But then at the B, you know, back to that morning that we were given the choice to be flown out, we all decided not to. Well, shortly thereafter, we developed a plan. Kind of each group was going to do this or that. We all had different assignments, and Holly was going with the less able women or leading them out in this big alfalfa field, which is fine, except for there were 66 horses and mules out there. That spooked when the fire.
Probably not at their most calm.
Right, so they're stampeding around in a big circle, and I was in charge of a massive haystack, 2,000 some bales or some such, but,
with minimal
firefighting equipment. I had a hose, and we had a couple sprinklers set up, totally inadequate, and it went up early. And then there was the manager and his assistant that were somewhere around the shop, or they were doing additional watering. And we had a pump that was further up Brush Creek that was providing the water that we were using for these various things. And there was the hotshot crew boss, Doug Graves, was up there managing that pump to make sure, you know, it was functioning, and or probably putting more gas
right.
in it because there was gas there.
Right.
And we didn't realize the danger that he ultimately was in, because he saved his life by, we had to use a backhoe, they had a backhoe there, to dig a big pocket in the stream to make a pool for pumping the water out of. But he got in that pool with just his mouth sticking out, and that's how he made it. Or he would have been.
All the trees and the riparian burned up around
him. Yeah, very high intensity. So, but
his radio ended up in the pond, and the other guy dropped his when he was fleeing flames coming after.
And we had our student, very athletic, Chris, and the other Forest Service firefighter that were initiating a back burn. And it was just hopeless. I mean, it was way beyond what you could do with a back burn. The lookout, Middle Fork Peak, had said that, he said, "I'm out of here. There's a wall of
flames." He was 8 miles further from the fire.
1,000 feet high, headed towards you. And he says, a fire of biblical proportions. Yeah,
right.
So that's
the last
word.
Don't panic, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't panic. And, you know, we're right by this thing.
Right.
And he's getting out of there.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a harbinger of what was going to happen. But Chris and the other firefighter had to flee, jump over some fences, and they got a little bit singed by the fires and went over the top of them. But there's just so many small situations where somebody could have easily died.
Did you guys lose any horses?
The flying bee did.
Yeah. And again, there were all these fires in the backcountry, so they had another facility of theirs about 25 miles from Taylor Ranch that had fire near it, so they brought those horses back to the Flying Bee.
So they had a pretty big buildup.
And so then they had them loose up in the wilderness, and 3 times the manager went up to collect horses, and he actually went the very morning of the fire.
He did.
And he couldn't find 3 or 4 of them.
They were never to be seen again. Yeah.
But we had several of our mules got injured during the fire. They were really scared because where our mules were is near this barn that was on fire, and pieces were just blowing away,
trying to keep the fire
from. And landing near the mules. And so one of our mules, we still have, she's 34 years old.
Oh my gosh.
She wanted to run away from all of this burning stuff, and she just ran into a barbed wire fence, and our student Chris saw her run into the fence,
bounce off,
and she backed up and she ran as hard as she could and just blasted through it.
Yeah.
And so she had these like marks all across her chest that were cuts from the barbed wire, and then all the rest of the animals followed her, and so they were out loose when we found them.
Dang.
But it was more superficial. Her body was just shaking like jelly when we found them. She was just so scared.
Right.
But it wasn't anything that was lasting. But a month later, one of our other mules had this football-sized abscess on his butt. And we think that like a shard from the barn or a piece of
hawthorn
or something got embedded, because the wind was like hurricane winds, embedded deep inside of him. And we had to have the vet come cut it out.
So there's a suspension bridge on the Middle Fork that is embedded in concrete on both sides. It was built in 1950.
Wow.
And big, huge, one foot high I-beams, steel I-beams, and embedded in concrete. And those pulled out of the concrete. And the bridge was just racking and smashing the concrete and making this horrific noise. And three of the gals that had been in the lodge, we suggested that their safety valve was to get to the river. Several of us were going
into the
river. Yeah, thinking under the bridge, because, you know, flying debris, you'd be somewhat safe.
Right.
They were really freaked out by the bridge. So they ultimately had to float downstream, and they had their eyebrows burned.
Yeah.
From having their faces like this in the water, and the riparian was burning so hot. But the manager of the bee, kind of last minute, I mean, I had pretty much given up on the haystack, but I saw him, and he said to me, "Jim, did you cut the fence for your mules to get to the river?" And I said, "No, I haven't." So he threw me the fencing pliers, and I went and saw Cricket, at that time our smartest mule, and said, "Cricket, come on." And she came, and the others followed, and I cut the fence, and she went in like she was going down by the stream. And one of them made a noise of some sort, like, "I'm not going," and made some vocalization. And then Cricket turned around, ran right by me, and they just took off into the smoke and were gone. And so, you know, plan that didn't pan out. You know, they were too freaked to be able to recognize that they could get out in the water. But, you know, it probably wouldn't have been the best for them. I think their departure was better.
Well, the riparian would have been bad, because it would have... The shrubs were all on fire. I don't know if they would know to go out in the stream. When we were at Taylor Ranch, we thought, "Oh, well, we'll just turn them loose if we have to. Either get in the water with them or turn them loose on the bunch grass hillsides." Because you think, you know, bunch grass, it can't burn too much. Oh, yeah, it burns downhill with the wind, and it burns 100%. So even the slopes would not have been safe.
You know, and I guess, you know, we're kind of jumping around with this story, but it's sort of indicative of the time. You just react over and over. You react to what's in front of you at this time. And I ended up in the shop with the bee manager and his assistant, and we're dealing with this hurricane force wind. Not knowing if the shop's going to ignite or not, but at least we were out of it, and we could breathe. And we'd had a hard time even getting into that building because of the pressure gradient difference between the outside air and in the shop.
Oh, totally.
I couldn't open the door.
Yeah.
And they came along and helped me, and we pushed, you know, we got in, and we had our dog, Micah, at that time, in there, and he had his dog, Buck. And so we were five of us in there, and there would be this horrific hurricane sound, and then it stopped. And so we go outside, and we see things on fire. The woodshed was on fire with about 14 cords of firewood. And there was two functioning hoses. We could see they were running. And they went and put out the roof of that fire, and I went and put out the roof of a building that was housing about a dozen propane tanks, which would have been, you know, a major bomb.
They're horrifying when they explode. Yeah. I was on a fire when it exploded, and it was terrifying.
There was at least 12 of those big canisters together. But I was able to get that out, and then we hear this roaring sound again with the fire coming down a different side drainage. So we run back in the shop, and we're in there, and same scenario again. There was three events of fire fronts coming. The first one was the worst, though, wasn't it?
We might have experienced different things over where I was.
Yeah, it was like a 100-mile-an-hour wind, an 80-mile-an-hour wind, a 50-mile-an-hour wind. I would equate it to that, and I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Oh, certainly not.
Of the wind power we were dealing with, but... And then the second time I went out, had to put out that propane building again. And when I got close to that thing, I remember my heart was pounding because I knew, you know, if there's an ignition here, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. But I also think that at that time I breathed too hot of air, too, because I have always felt that after that event, my lungs were never the same. And I, you know, start of asthma and stuff like that, and I think that was a big factor. We breathed some pretty awful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, not just for that, from that instance, just the before,
mm-hmm.
and then obviously the after, being surrounded. Right. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a good segue. You know, you go through all these true survival instances of reacting and trying to save not only your home, but, you know, somebody else's, the flying bee, to then going back.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah.
That was depressing right after the fire, in particular at the flying bee, you know, when all the adrenaline disappeared the next morning. It was like, oh, this is ugly. Everything was burned. I mean, this was like 100%.
Yeah.
And there were dead animals and dead birds.
Yeah.
When we got back to Taylor Ranch was kind of like a little oasis because we watered the pastures and the airstrip, and then the firefighters had protected right around the buildings. They'd even done some back burns to protect beyond the buildings. So it was like black except for the buildings and the pasture and the airstrip. And I ended up flying back in because our dog got hurt at Taylor Ranch, or at the Flying Bee, and I had to take her out to the vet. And it was just like flying over miles and miles and miles of just burned land, burned forest. And then there was this little green jewel that we were going to land at. So that really influenced even like what the animals did, because we had all sorts of animals that moved into our little green spot. The deer that survived. We did have a cougar that was radio collared that we think the collar melted down, because she was just up.
She likely melted.
Less than a mile from Taylor Ranch when we left, and we never got a signal again.
Wow.
But there was a cougar that came onto the airstrip, and she killed a doe and a fawn. And I was walking on the airstrip, and I saw these legs sticking out because they piled like grass on top of it. I saw legs sticking out, and then I see more legs sticking out on the other side. It's like, oh my gosh, what happened here?
Yeah.
And it was a cougar that had killed them on the airstrip. And then we had the bears came and took it over from the cougar. So this was this little tiny spot that was still green, was very attractive to the predators and the prey.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just a lot of emotion. And like back to the bee, we decided we needed to see what the water intake looked like up Brush Creek. So I went up there with a guy that was working there who was a Vietnam vet. And he'd experienced napalm and some pretty ugly stuff in Vietnam. And he was having a hard time. And then we get to the point of, we come upon this deer that's had all its hair burned off of it, but it was still alive, and it was obviously in a lot of pain. And I said to him, "Well, you stay here. I'm going to go get my handgun." I didn't have a handgun, and so I went running back and came back with a handgun. And by the time I finished that deer off, that guy was in a bad way, It was just flashback to Vietnam is what it amounted to. And there was just lots of little tense episodes that occurred.
Everybody was mad at each other.
Yeah, there was a strange, it created a strange culture of this weird anxiety of having all this adrenaline, and then you're left with this ugliness, and we've got to do something. So, you know, we put out the structure fires that were going on as good as we could, and we started some cleanup. But it was a strange, emotional time. And I guess I would have never guessed at that time we would have continued on at Taylor Ranch, but you know, we stayed another 10 years after that.
Yeah, saw the green up once again.
Probably not the smartest thing to do professionally, because our first couple years we were all recovered from the fire.
Yeah, so we did have trouble with our research after that, because we had more of a need to deal with facilities issues at Taylor Ranch, that we weren't able to focus on the research as much. Plus, the whole environment had changed. So, you know, when you're trying to do a study about, well, how do wolves affect cougars? And this giant forest fire changes everything, because the winter after the fire, everything was burned. So the elk just left. They weren't even there. The wolves left. They weren't there. And so we had a whole new environment that different things were happening. Mm-hmm. We had moose that were dying of starvation, and then the cougars killed them because there were no deer and elk to kill. We had.
So did you end up turning that into anything? I mean, like the
We wrote that up. And really, one of the interesting findings we had, you know, in looking at cougars and wolves and how they persist, wolves are in packs and cougars are in individual animals, or maybe a family group of a female and young. And so with this massive fire in the whole winter range, the elk were very adaptable. They just went to another winter range. The wolves, their winter range was so gigantic at that time because there weren't many packs. Mm-hmm. They just went with the elk.
Yeah.
And so they left. But cougars have specific spots that they
very geographically tied.
They didn't have the option to leave. And so we had cougars that were starving to death, too.
Yeah.
And so
killing moose, which was
what we found was with a huge event like a big forest fire, the strategy of wolves is much more adaptable than cougars because of their ability to move and get into somewhere else that provided their food
and we saw cougars killing cougars.
Yeah.
Cougars killing eagles, and it was just
cougars killing a beaver.
Yeah, it was just kind of a stirred up system.
Anything and everything, because they were starving.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways it was fascinating, but professionally, was it the smartest thing to do? Probably not. But again, we opted for the interest, the fascination, the adventure of staying. That would have been a good time to leave, to be honest.
Well, but I think our education programs, though, really blossomed,
they did
too,
blossom,
after that.
Yeah.
And the students got involved with a lot more research and investigating things post-fire.
Yeah.
So there were some good years after that.
No, there were.
The research suffered more than the education.
Yeah.
Yeah, with priorities changing, I mean, you still have to appreciate the time and energy you guys put into your home. It's like, hey, we got to see this thing through to at least get some grass growing.
Yeah, and all the fences burned because they were wood rail. But yeah, I mean, it was an adventurous time for sure. And the trails really got ugly. You know, it's just really difficult to keep trails up after massive fire like that.
And now we've started a trails association here, and we clear trails in the wilderness here every year.
That's awesome.
Especially fire zones.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, can't get away from it.
Obviously left an imprint on you guys. With your guys' role, obviously, at Taylor Ranch and then helping at Flying Bee, what was it like being the point people for some of those priority restoration acts, if you will, of just like, hey, you talk about priorities changing, of we got to worry about the facilities here. You talk about the trails and the airstrip and all the things that Taylor Ranch is besides the
programs.
Yeah.
So one of the things we lost was our cookhouse and a bunkhouse. So that was the, we had tents pretty short term, where we had students in tents, but the biggest building project we had was a brand new log, two-story log cabin that was actually done by you know, a contractor that flew all the logs in to build this cabin. And so we were quite involved with that construction project too.
Yeah, and we had a very generous funder, donor, the DeVlieg Foundation provided money for that, which a private entity, private foundation, you know, you, to come up with a structure like that and all the flying with bringing the materials in, you know, it's not going to be within normal university budgeting opportunities. So that was big. And I think you're right. It did lead to some of our best years. I would say 04 to 07, we had Taylor Ranch running at perhaps its best it ever has. And some of it was the fascination with fire. You know, the whole interest in the aquatic system, I think, really came about post-fire.
A lot of external researchers from Idaho State University and U of I that brought grad students in. And, and our students always got to work with all of them, so that was wonderful, too.
And NOAA Fisheries, and just a lot of different entities. And the Forest Service, too. And so it, I don't know, it was worth staying, I guess. But I do wonder, looking back.
So with all that being said, you know, what were, you talk about the highs and lows of researching and stuff, but what was your favorite little day-to-day routine there? Just like the most simple things. You talk about having to, you know, the beauty of being able to be self-sufficient.
Day-to-day?
Changed with the season.
I suppose one of the things we did, we had several day-to-day routines. One of them was we had to go up and check the water box. So our water came right out of the stream, and we drank it without filtration, partly because we never tested it. So we didn't know.
It was a side drainage.
Nobody got sick, so we didn't. Well, we had available filters in the other cabins, but no one ever used them. But every day you'd have to go up and clear the screen where the water went from the stream into the pipe. So that was just a nice little hike up the drainage that was a pleasant little interlude.
I like taking the weather. We were an official weather station. So taking coffee and just checking what the weather was and kind of guessing, you know, what the high and the low was. And or how much precipitation, since we had a rain gauge.
Well, and then every morning we had to call the weather in. And so that meant we had to turn the radio on and listen to the chatter and talk to each other. And then when it was time, we'd call our weather in. We'd, once a week, we'd call our mail, our grocery order in. So our social part, like when there weren't many people at Taylor, the radio was more important. In the summer when we were really busy, it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
get on the radio off. Get the weather called in and turn it off.
Yeah.
No, and then I feeding the mules. Actually, would usually do the weather in conjunction with going down to the barn and feeding the mules. It's another part of that routine.
But we usually had the spotting scope out just to check what was happening where.
Across the canyon.
I think one of my favorite days was when we were watching the Super Bowl, which we had gotten TV that this donor had given us, a direct TV, which I'm not sure why we didn't really want it, but she wanted to give it to us. And so we were watching the Super Bowl, and at the same time we were looking with the spotting scope watching a pack of wolves up on the hill. And they're up there fiddling around, and we see, you know, you can tell the alpha male and the omega wolf that's slinking around, and they play, and then one of them starts following these chuckers in the snow, and we could watch with the scope and just see he's following the tracks and sniffing like a bird dog, and then the chuckers flew, and he got to the end and went, what happened to him? But, you know, we had those incidental observations all the time. You just never knew what was going to show up. Sometimes we'd hear the wolves. I think we had heard them that morning. And then we watched them go up the hill, and they just hung out, you know, all day up there.
Yeah, that's a pretty good Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah.
It's
like, which do you want to watch?
Yeah, pretty unique to Taylor Range. Taylor Range only.
We were the only Americans that were doing that.
Certainly. Yeah, it's pretty rare to have a spotting scope out during the Super Bowl.
Yep.
But, you know, as we talked before we turned on the mic, you know, what's our whole purpose in doing this? It's to get advice and to be able to talk with people who have been there and done that. So what's some advice that you have to the next round of people who live at Taylor Ranch, or next round of researchers or outdoor enthusiasts?
My advice, which I mentioned before, I would say my advice is to continue to do what you love to do and don't be in a hurry to move up the ladder, because once you've passed that fun stuff, you usually don't get a chance to go back. But it's difficult to find that fine line of professionalism, but still, adventure and excitement and things that you love. But I think too often people feel the need to move up the career ladder. And I'd say, take a look before you make that jump and think about what your opportunities that you are leaving. Because I think we were glad that we didn't move up in a quick way, because we had a lot more adventure.
Right.
I guess my advice would be to never forget to look back. In other words, how people did things in the past, and perhaps think about the reasons for that. I guess I see some things dying now, such as the stock use capabilities of today's world. And when I see people using stock, they're not using them in a fully practical, efficient manner. It's more, say, for instance, show. And they don't really immerse in the heritage and the tradition of stock use. And I guess, and it's more that stock's just one example. You know, it's an approach in how you go about accomplishing tasks and not being afraid to jump in and do things manually, and as opposed to always being dependent upon mechanization to make it easier. And that can be applied in a lot of different realms. And I think also to keep seeking adventure. I mean, the world still has a lot of adventure opportunities. I just feel that we, and some of it's due to modern society, lack of familiarity with functioning, particularly in wild places. And there's this fear of that. And people need to put their fears aside and go experience the outdoors and nature firsthand and learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The other thing I was going to say, related to more of a recreational bent, is to experience nature in an intensive way. And that was more our lifestyle. We didn't travel very far. You can't travel very far on foot. So we knew a small area really well, and we knew the animals, and we knew the plants, and we knew the history and the geology. And I think that, you know, when people go to the wilderness, learn everything and experience everything about a place. You know, that place-based knowledge is really empowering, and it's exciting. So many of our wilderness areas have a great human history too.
Yeah, they do.
And to me, it's all part of being in the wilderness or being in nature, is not just the plants and animals, but the physical environment, the people that came before. What did they think? How did they live back there? You know, just imagining sheep eater Indians living where we lived and wintering back there, thinking how cold that might have been.
Yeah.
And these homesteaders that were digging, you know, cutting out bathtubs out of logs. It's just unfathomable, but it's just so fascinating to think about and learn about and realize how other people lived in that same environment.
Yeah.
So I would say, expand the depth of knowledge about a small place is probably more important than going to lots of places and experiencing them more in a superficial way.
Yeah, and I think that tapping into the experiences of those folks who have experienced. In other words, do like what you're doing. You know, cultivate conversation with your elders, so to speak. And I just really think that that's something that's always been valuable and perhaps more important now than ever before, I think. And people need to spend a little bit of time away from technology. And, you know, like you guys' generation, you're pretty good at that. It seems like you recognize that. I worry about the generation that's younger than you, though, and not recognizing that, you know, that is an option because technology's spoon-fed kids today, and they really know no different. And that is worrisome. So as you guys become in our age bracket, it's going to be important that you convey to probably the kids of those kids we're talking about, the importance of experiencing the outdoors in whatever capacity, firsthand, though, and minimize the technological advantages to do so. And that's kind of a tricky one.
Yeah, but just get outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, ultimately.
Yeah, because like where we live, the big access way, get into the Frank Church and a lot of those big wildernesses of central Idaho and Montana is with bush plane. And, you know, that's technology.
Right.
But at least when you get there, you know, you don't have to bring everything in the kitchen sink that's technological.
Mm-hmm.
Leave that stuff behind and just have a backpack and in your feet, in your physical condition to go
and your favorite meal.
Yeah,
that's where I am now.
You're going to fly the mule a little bit.
No.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, thank you guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
This has been awesome.
Well, we talked nonstop for you.
Yeah.
This is perfect.
Exactly. Yeah.
Lots of editing involved, probably.
Honestly, not.
Yeah. When we get a set of people like you guys, it's so fun. One, just to watch how you guys converse, and then it's easy for us to just sit back when you guys have.
We can carry it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now it's my turn.
Yeah.
Do you guys know the Huntseekers?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well.
Yeah, theirs was pretty much uncut too. We just let them go.
Cool.
It was very lovely.
Yeah. So Jim used to work for Dave in the 70s.
No, it was the early 80s, about 80, 81. Oh. It was right before we went to King Ranch the first time. I was a wilderness planner for Dave.
Oh, okay.
And he was the head of the recreation program in the BLM.
Oh, gotcha. Yep. So. It's come full circle. We've had a lot of
It is interesting, these totally different people you're talking to. It's like, oh, yeah, we have a really good connection with them. Oh, yeah, we know them really well.
Again, we just want to thank you for listening. We really appreciate it as a new podcast starting out. If you feel so inclined, please like, subscribe, leave us a review. It really helps share our podcast other places. If you want to follow us on social media, it's Decades on Dirt Roads Pod on both Facebook and Instagram. And if you want to communicate with us in a different way, you can shoot us an email at decadesondirtroads@gmail.com.